as we begin our program tonight, I'm very happy to welcome back to our program Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of many important books. Her latest is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. Phyllis, great to have you back on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
So you, along with many others in the U.S. and around the world, celebrated the fact that opponents of the international nuclear agreement with Iran and their efforts to derail the pact had failed in the U.S. Congress. And the larger victory of diplomacy over war, at least in this short run here, is what we're talking about. Anything can happen. But I wonder if you begin, Phyllis, by talking about the significance of this moment with what appears to be a congressional non-objection, or at least non-official objection, to this pact.
Yeah, you know, Scott, this is really a victory in two ways. On the substantive part, this is an extraordinarily important development. The victory, as you said, of diplomacy over war, the substance of this agreement that is so important, even though when you step back from it and say, well, wait a minute, Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon. All 16 U.S. intelligence agencies agree it hasn't even made the decision about whether it wants a nuclear weapon or not, for God's sakes. But nonetheless, it will never be able to produce a nuclear weapon at least in the next 25 years. And in the meantime, the sanctions that have just crippled the civilian economy in Iran will begin to be lifted. So that's all huge. And then, of course, it sets the stage for even greater potential gains in terms of potential engagement between the U.S. and Iran, something that really hasn't existed in a formal way since 1979, the possibility of new kinds of diplomacy aimed at ending the war in Iraq and the war in Syria that are giving rise to these huge flows of refugees out of the region. All of that is possible. None of it is inevitable, but all of that becomes possible with this agreement. And then on the political side, when we look at how this happened, this was a huge victory over AIPAC and the rest of the pro-Israel lobby. It was a victory over the manufacturers of the war industries, the war profiteers, if you will. It was a victory over Dick Cheney and his merry band of neocons who wanted to do in Iran what they did so devastatingly in Iraq. It was a victory over all of them. AIPAC alone put in $40 million in this 60-day campaign to win public support. And we didn't have anything close to that. But we had people, and we had the facts on our side. And what a surprise. We were able to convince enough members of Congress. Of course, it came down along strict party lines, so it was all Democrats. Can take it. So it was recognizing the degree to which there has been a massive shift in discourse in this country already, and taking advantage of that discourse shift to escalate the pressure. So that's one lesson to be learned. Another lesson is that there's no substitute for having the president on your side. You know, I think we have to be careful in our assessments here that it wasn't only the grassroots side. That's what we can do and what we can control and what we can contribute. And we did, and it was brilliant, and it was fundamental to our victory. But we can't pretend that it doesn't matter that the President of the United States was fighting hard for the same thing we were fighting for, which was for this agreement to be protected, for this agreement to pass. That was huge. And, you know, again, that's not going to happen all the time. We don't agree with the President very, very often when it's issues of war and peace. Plenty of other issues, too, but those are the issues we're talking about tonight. But on those rare moments when the president is on the right side of history, we've got to use that. We've got to build that connection. We've got to back it up. So that was another lesson. We can't have illusions, but we've got to take advantage. So, you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. There were a lot of organizations involved. There were twice a week phone calls to coordinate strategy, to build messaging together. But there wasn't a lot of time wasted on creating the structures of a whole new organization or a new coalition or whatever that would have taken up a lot of time that people didn't have when we had a 60-day window to win this victory. That was another lesson. We learned that lesson in 2013 in the fight to prevent the bombing of Syria at that time, and it worked well then as well. So, you know, I think that we're learning a lot of these lessons. And then finally, I would say that the question of making links with other parts of our movement, so the question of the costs of this war, the militarization of our police in this country that is so rooted in the military actions of our military forces around the world, why those things don't matter, why those things don't work, why we need diplomacy rather than war for our own sake, as well as for the sake of the people in the rest of the world. These were all important lessons, you know, that when throughout this summer, when the issue of Black Lives Matter and police killing of young black people was so central to the lives of so many people and to the work of so much of our movement, being able to make links between the Black Lives Matter movement and the question of what happens when you militarize what should be a political conflict, this was crucial. So there's lots and lots of lessons here.
And just to reiterate what you said a moment ago about President Obama, there are plenty of disagreements on the left with Obama and his administration, foreign policy, as well as domestic decisions he's made. But this one in particular, I think, sticks out as a promise kept, because it was in the 2008 debates with Hillary Clinton. He talked about diplomacy as an option as opposed to the Bush administration's war policies, and he deserves credit for keeping that commitment.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think there was also an issue when he used the language even earlier about not just opposing the war in Iraq, not just promising to end the war in Iraq, but promising to end the mindset that leads to war. And I would say that was not a promise kept. But the specific one about negotiating, about diplomacy with Iran, was a promise kept. And I think the fact that he fought hard for this, I mean, he was on the phone with hundreds of members of Congress. There were reports of, constant kind of politicking behind the scenes on this. And the fact that the White House actually put out a video attacking Cheney when Cheney took the lead in calling directly for war against Iran. The White House put out a video that could have come straight out of Jon Stewart's shop on The Daily Show. It was quite extraordinary.
Yeah. We're speaking with Phyllis Spinnis tonight on Counterpoint. She's director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of many books. Her latest is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. Phyllis, with a new nuclear agreement moving forward, what do you think the potential is for improved relations between the U.S. and Iran, and how could that affect cooperation in ending current wars, current bloody wars now ongoing in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen?
Well, you know, Scott, there's no question that there's already much closer collaboration in the Middle East in these wars between the United States and Iran. It's true that inside Syria, the U.S. and Iran are on opposite sides relative to the regime in Damascus. Iran is providing military support to the Assad regime. The U.S. is trying to undermine the Assad regime, and earlier on was attacking it politically more directly. But in Iraq, for instance, the collaboration between the U.S. and Iran is very overt. Today, a big piece in the front page of the New York Times documenting the military collaboration in one base in particular. There's a group of U.S. special forces that are dealing directly with Iranian-trained Shia militias that once were responsible for the deaths of many U.S. occupation soldiers in Iraq in the earlier stages of the U.S. occupation and the U.S. war. So that's one of the vivid sort of examples of this shift. But we're also looking at a situation, and if you look at Yemen, there's the potential for some real collaboration to tamp down the level of violence that has been so badly exacerbated by the Saudis as they have begun this massive bombing campaign with absolutely devastating humanitarian results, and particularly in Afghanistan, where since 2001, the U.S. and Iran have really shared a commitment to opposing the Taliban, to supporting a different kind of government, the government that was put in place by the United States during the U.S. occupation in the earliest stages, was actually helped to be created by the government in Iran, who participated on an equal footing with the U.S. in the Bonn Conference in 2001 that led to the government that was created in Kabul right after the overthrow of the Taliban. So there's history of this. And in fact, if you look back to 2002, Iran offered a kind of grand bargain that would include broad negotiations over pretty much everything that was dividing the U.S. and Iran at that point, including Iran's role in the region, its relationships with Hezbollah and Hamas, issues of human rights, the U.S. denial of Iran's legitimacy as a Middle Eastern power. All of those things would be on the table. The Bush administration, of course, answered that call. The Iranians made a call for a grand bargain. Bush answered it with the accusation that Iran was part of the so-called axis of evil. And what a surprise, there were no more negotiations after that. But there is enormous potential now to build on those shared interests, particularly in Iraq and Syria, all-party negotiations in Syria. The Iranians have been calling for years for a nuclear weapons-free zone throughout the Middle East, which would, of course, have to start with the existing nuclear arsenal that belongs to Israel that's already destabilizing the region. That's something that, ironically, the U.S. is, in fact, legally obligated to. It legally supports it, but it's never acknowledged. That was in, you'll remember this, Scott.
We only have about a minute or two left, and I think I'll just ask you this as a final question here, and that is, Russia has recently deployed soldiers and military equipment to Syria, a move that the United States has condemned. Is there any possibility that Russia's presence there could be a prelude to a negotiated settlement to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and pave the way for a negotiated end to the war with some interim leadership there?
I don't see the likelihood that there's going to be a move to oust Assad that Russia would participate in. I think the possibility of a negotiated settlement is definitely a very live possibility. It would probably look like the rather vague language that was used in the second version of the Geneva proposal from the United Nations that talked about a transitional government of some kind of national unity involving people both from the opposition and from the existing government without mentioning Assad, without mentioning that he would stay or that he would go. Having Russian forces training Syrian troops in how to use the weapons that Russia's providing is not anything new. I think part of the new information is a timing issue designed to keep the pressure on regarding the deal with Iran and, you know, to keep that pressure up. The Senate is scheduled to take another vote tomorrow. We assume it will go the same way as the vote did on Thursday, that there will be an overwhelming ability to prevent the Iran deal from being undermined. But I think that those negotiations are going to have to start with the recognition that everybody has to be at the table. That means Iran has to be at the table, and the Assad regime, and the armed opposition, and, crucially, civil society inside Syria, those that remain, those that have not been killed or forced into exile, have to have a place at the table, as well as all of the regional countries that are sending in arms, etc. If there's going to be a negotiated settlement, there's going to have to be an arms embargo, because as long as all sides are continuing to flood the region with new arms on a daily basis, no negotiated solution is going to last. And the U.S. certainly has no credibility to demand that Russia stop arming the Assad regime as long as the U.S. is collaborating in the arming of massive numbers of unaccountable opposition forces. So there's going to have to be an all-sided arms embargo. That's not something anybody is talking about at this point, but we've got to start getting the idea out there that it's not an outlier of an idea, that it's something that's going to be a necessity if we're serious about ending this crippling, horrifying war.
And any negotiations, of course, would not include the forces of ISIS, a group that would not participate in negotiations at any rate.
You know, I think that we also, I mean, right now that's probably true. I don't see any evidence that anybody is talking to anybody in ISIS. But that doesn't mean, number one, that that could never happen. I mean, if you look at other earlier negotiating processes with what were known as terrorist organizations, including in Northern Ireland, where it took years before the British were prepared to deal with the Provisional IRA because they said they're nothing but terrorists, we're not going to talk to them. And then, you know, there are reports now that there may be negotiations already underway, private negotiations towards a long-term ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, something Israel said it would never happen. I'm not necessarily advocating that we start by trying to negotiate with ISIS. I think that, among other things, you're probably right that right now they're not prepared to negotiate, nor is any outside power prepared to talk with them. But those kinds of things change, and we certainly will be negotiating with governments and non-governmental forces of various sorts who are responsible for providing arms and money to ISIS. So we're going to have to, you know, have that at the table, because at the end of the day, this is the crucial lesson that was both learned and taught by former Senator George Mitchell after the Good Friday Accords that he helped negotiate. He said the first lesson is, if you're serious about diplomacy, everybody has to be at the table. And if they're not, you're guaranteeing failure, because all of your enemies will have no obligation to abide by whatever is decided. So that we have to keep that in mind, too, that ISIS is not distinct from that reality.
Well,
the goal
said.
Is to end the war. At some point, there's going to have to be everybody at the table. That's not the first step. But somewhere along the line, some version of that will probably have to happen.
Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Apologies to you and our listeners for the interruption on our line. I don't know what happened. It was kind of a new one. But
No problem. It was good to be with you, Scott.
Leave our listeners with a web address where people can read your recent articles.
IPS-DC.org.
IPS-DC.org. Thanks again, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Bye-bye. That's Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and author of the newest book of hers is titled Understanding ISIS in the New Global War on Terror, a Primer.